Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Giuseppe Porcaro, and we are here for another episode of The Sound of Economics. Today, we will speak about the political economy of climate transition, and I'm pleased to dive deep into the topic with our guests. Heather Grabe, director of the Open Society European Policy Institute here in Brussels. Hi, Heather. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
And Piotr Arak, director of the Polish Economic Institute, joining the Sound of Economics from Warsaw. Hello, Piotr. How are you?
Hi, I'm good, although the times could be better.
I can imagine. How is the situation with the pandemic over there in Warsaw?
So I would say that through the last week, I guess the situation became a little bit more in control because the number of cases was growing quite rapidly in Poland, but currently we're doing better. But what worries me is the excessive death rate, which we see in the statistics and the additional deaths of people who couldn't go to the doctor throughout the year and probably are going to die of different causes than COVID, actually. We saw that before in different EU countries, and now it's in Poland.
That's very sad to hear, of course. And I also want to introduce our last guest, but not least, who is Simone Tagliapietra, our scholar at Bruegel, who joins us from Italy. Ciao Simone, come stai?
Ciao Giuseppe, tutto bene? Hello to everyone.
So, without no further ado, I would like to introduce the theme of today, which is a theme, climate transition, which is being hotly debated within the European Union policy circle, and it's linked to the ambitious climate targets set by the President of the European Commission with the European Green Deal, but also tied to the discussions of the next budget of the Union and the recovery plan from the current pandemic. It is, though, also a topic more widely on the table globally, as we will see in 2021, with the changes in the US administration, COP26 happening under the lead of the UK, and much more. So, the value of this European debate has several layers and consequences at different geographical scales, definitely at the level of European policy, certainly at the level of the impact at national and regional level, but also an important element in global politics. And zooming in the core issue we want to tackle with our guest today, I would like to remind you that the aim of the European Green Deal is to intelligently promote decarbonization by accompanying the economic and industrial transformation this necessarily implies, and by ensuring the social inclusiveness of the overall process. So issues spanning from just transition to distributional effects of climate policies, from sustainable finance to green investments, are all key political economy prerequisites for the successful unfolding of the decarbonization process. And I would like to ask Simone to kick off our analysis, as he has been writing extensively at Bruegel about that. Simone, what is your take and general introduction to the topic?
Thank you very much, Giuseppe. This is a very important topic indeed, because up to, let's say, a couple of years ago, basically, climate policy, I would say, was still, let's say, niche. Climate policy was done with the classical climate policy tools, with the classical energy policy tools. We didn't really have, in the recent past, really such a more macro view on the effects of these policies on the economy and society overall, I would say. Then things started to change, and this change was really rapid. I think that the acceleration of the decarbonization pledges, so the build-up of this net zero coalition that now sees the United States, China, Japan, South Korea, soon the United States, is really telling us that the transformation will happen in a quick manner, and therefore this will be really a massive transformation that will touch all the corner of the economy and of the society. On the other hand, I think the Gilets Jaunes in France has shown in a very turbulent manner also, that one cannot pursue climate policy without taking into consideration the distributional effects of climate policy. So the convergence of these two issues has really led over the last year and a half, I would say, and I think the European Green Deal is a first policy response globally to this issue, that we need to develop a new macroeconomics of decarbonization, a new political economy of decarbonization. It is clear that the transition, the decarbonization process will only be sustainable in the long run if we get the socio-economic dimensions right. Now, to be honest, I think that even in the academic debate, we still don't have a clear framework of understanding of all the macroeconomic dimensions of this transformation. If you look at the literature, we see traditionally two schools of thought. We see the green growth school on the one hand and the degrowth school on the other. The debate tends to be very polarized. But I think that the challenge of the next months and years will be the one of developing a sort of third way that takes decarbonization as an exogenous element. So it's a given, it's our societal goal to get there, because we know that the cost of inaction will be much bigger than the cost of action. So this is something we have to do. The issue is how to do it. And therefore, you see how issues such as green industrial policy, such as just transition, or such as the tackling of the distributional effects of climate policy becomes central in the decarbonization process. So the European Green Deal is a way to push climate action beyond the traditional borders of climate policy, to also embrace this socio-economic dimension. And I think that this is key, because either we get these fundamentals right, or the transition will embark into a very difficult pathway that will also see refusal from society and from the political forces around it.
Thank you, Simone. And of course, we are going to dive even a bit more deep into some of the stuff that that you mentioned afterwards, especially considering what is the toolbox that we have at our disposals in order to change this economy, and then what kind of policies and what kind of impact this is going to have in the society and the political systems. But I would like to hear first from Heather, then from Piotr, their take around this more general overview that Simone just provided us.
Thanks. It's great how Simona set out so clearly that it's not about whether the climate transition will happen, it's about how. And the how matters greatly to whether it actually succeeds. There's at the moment quite a high level of consensus among Europeans about the need for climate action. The vast majority believe that climate change is happening, that it's human-made on the whole, and that action is needed. But once you start to probe what kinds of economic measures people are prepared to accept under the European Green Deal, this consensus becomes very soft. And once it's probed by some populist forces, those who are already aggrieved by the impact of globalization on society and are feeling the injustices of previous economic transitions, it will be really hard to maintain democratic consent over the at least couple of decades ahead that will be needed for the European Green Deal fully to transform the economies into zero carbon. So in order to get the political economy right, we have to look at the policy mix, and especially the sequencing of economic policies, because people need to have not just effective measures, that's vital, of course, because the costs of inaction, as Simona said, are absolutely enormous, but people also need to have a sense of what living in a low-carbon economy might actually be like, what kinds of opportunities they'll have, what kind of social security they'll have, whether or not it will just be another case of globalization leaving a lot of left-behinds who kind of get forgotten about until they're roused by rabble-rousing populists who simply want to smash things up. No, instead, what's really needed is to think about what kind of deeper engagement with the public about climate measures is necessary and how the social effects can be cushioned by the state as well as these new economic opportunities. If the EU doesn't get the political economy right, then the transition simply will not happen because the political opposition will be so great. And that's why some of these highly technical discussions going on at EU level around the taxonomy, for example, around carbon pricing, needs to come out into the public debate in a much more understandable way.
Thank you, Heather. And Piotr, as I mentioned earlier, this is an issue that needs as well some sort of reality checks from the policy debate and circles and a view from the ground. I would like to ask you as well, as I did with Heather, a general feedback from Simone's presentation, but also somehow if you can give us a view from your special observatory where you are in Warsaw and Poland, in more generally speaking.
Thank you. Thanks for your presentation and general overview of the challenges that we face as the European Union and also the world, because it's not only Poland, it's not only the European Union, but also many other countries around the world are looking on this discussion that we have here in Europe. From Kentucky to South Australia, Ukraine, and also Indonesia, those countries which are also having, you know, different energy mixes, and also are going to go through a difficult period of adaptation if the commitment to climate neutrality is going to stick with us for many, many of the years to come. And I'm fairly certain that this will happen. So this debate where 90% of Europeans say that this is the most important issue that we need to tackle. In each European country, we have a consensus that this is something that truly is a problem. And for sure, in a country like Poland, which has an energy mix more like an emerging market than an advanced economy, the discussion is more difficult. The climate neutrality is a very heated political theme for many parties. When there were studies on political forces conducted by some European think tanks, then all Polish parties were seen as dinosaurs in terms of what they say about climate neutrality and what their actual policies are. This is also shifting through the last years and months, I would say even. In September 2020, which many international journalists cover, we saw a pledge of the trade unions, of miners, that the government will shut down the coal mines in Poland by 2049. Which wouldn't be probably possible, you know, and feasible 2 years before. But we see that the people who are going to be affected the most by climate neutrality and the goal. So they would have to find different ways of doing business, different ways of having, you know, bringing money to their homes. This is something that is here. And I would say that more and more people are aware of the challenge. But what they fear in a country like Poland, or probably in some of those emerging countries too, is that they don't know if they're not going to be left behind. So in Poland, we had that situation, and this is what causes the fear of the trade unions, because at the beginning of the 90s, almost none of the coal miners that lost their jobs due to the transition period and, you know, the reality check from a communist regime and a central planned economy to a market one, they didn't find new jobs. Those were the people who went on benefits or went on pensions. And they're scared because, you know, those people want to earn their living and they want to have a job, they want to have a future. And the process of giving that to them is truly important. And the second one is connected with the soft power of the trade unions. Please remember that in Poland, it's the trade unions that changed the political system in 1989. And on any political occasion, you're going to see a miner in his suit and singing and probably, you know, being present and being very active, which also means that this is a group of people which has a huge influence on politics, basically, not only on policy. So this is the difficulty and probably the difficulty of other countries, which also have to take into account what a large group of people and employees in the economy have to say, which makes the climate neutrality goal a real social challenge, not only a, you know, economic one, but also a social challenge.
Thank you, Piotr, for reminding us as well of the role of not only in the specific context of Poland, the symbolic role that the miners have been having in the history, in the recent history. It touches, as you say, both issues which are concretely economic and social issues, but also issues linked to soft power and how you have a buy-in somehow from a group of the population, which is an important group. And to me, one of the tools that is flagged and waved all the time as, I say, not the solution, but the one that would bring a solution to this issue, it's the greening of the industrial policy. It seems to me that this is considered one of the primary tools to combine the needs of a transition while keeping a narrative compatible with economic growth. I would like to ask Simone, what exactly is so special or different from the industrial policy in general, how it is or it relates to climate change policy. Give us a little bit of an insight about this tool. Is it really as important and as flexible and as we might want to think? Which are the challenges and what we can hope to get out of it?
Grazie, Giuseppe. Yes, I'm happy to talk about this also because at Bruegel we will release soon a new Bruegel blueprint on the development of an EU green industrial policy, which I had the pleasure to co-author together with our Bruegel colleague Renilde Wegelers. Green industrial policy wants to tackle at the same time both the objective of climate policy, which is decarbonization, and the objective of general industrial policy, which is economic competitiveness and job creation. This is a very vast challenge that requires green industrial policy to be developed with a very special policy toolkit. Now, what is the current situation in Europe? The situation that we currently have is of very profound fragmentation, because we see a lot of different green industrial policy initiatives being undertaken at regional level, at the national level, and then finally at the EU level. We have a very diversified landscape in which initiatives are even often not only not coordinated, but also conflicting. And this is a major threat, because the development of green technologies and the turning of the decarbonization process into an industrial opportunity for Europe, because at the end of the day, that is the target we want to achieve, can only be done if we have a certain scale. So if we make use of the single market and of the order of magnitude of the European single market as such. I think the challenge here is that the European Green Deal, so the quest to achieve climate neutrality by 2050, will entail a major shift in the European industrial structure, such as the one from fossil fuels to renewables, from diesel cars to electric cars. This will be an historical transformation that many have described as an industrial revolution against the deadline. And there, this is really to tell once more about the importance of coming up with innovative policy actions in this field. Now, what can be done at the European Union level to facilitate this process and to really come up with an EU green industrial policy? Well, first of all, we need to deal with this fragmentation that I mentioned already. It's not easy because national states consider industrial policy as a matter of their own sovereignty, and there are national interests. Everybody wants to have its own national champion in a certain area, and therefore there is a case to show the additionality of cooperating together in certain issues. I think this is becoming clear in certain areas, such as the area of batteries, for example, and that leads me to a first point, which is the development of European alliances. We have seen already since a couple of years now the development of this European battery alliance. The meaning of this initiative is to say, look, we Europeans are lagging behind in a technology that we know will be of paramount importance for the energy transition. Alone, it is very difficult to act here because we don't have the scale, we don't have even the right research and innovation frameworks for the development of these new forms of batteries. Therefore, we would better join our forces. How we do that? We create these consortia, such as Airbus, and we try to foster a cooperation among different countries and different companies in different countries to try to create a European value chain for batteries. This is something that is going on in batteries for 2 years. This is something that was launched as a new initiative on green hydrogen this year by the European Commission. And I think this is a very important tool to try to foster this coordination using, by the way, a very important policy tool that the EU has at its disposal, which is competition policy, because being part of these initiatives allow these companies to get state aid from the respective governments in order to invest in research and innovation and in order to really set up the manufacturing capacity that is required in this space. So creating these initiatives to tackle fragmentation with a good governance made of stick and carrots is, in my view, the first pillar for the development of an EU green industrial policy. Then there are many other dimensions, and let me just mention, for example, disruptive innovation. We still don't see in Europe the level of disruptive innovation we would require to come up with the most innovative solutions from renewable energy equipments to electric cars. We need to foster that, and I think that both the public sector and the private sector should do much more also together to take risks that are needed in this space. We need to mobilize investments, and there the EU has a key role to play, both with the taxonomy on sustainable finance that was mentioned before, but also with the development of a green bond market. And finally, we also need to exploit our single market and push the Green Deal beyond our borders, both with the application of environmental standards at home that also others will have to follow to sell their products to Europe, but also to make a better use of our development finance and to push the Green Deal beyond Europe border, for example, promoting green investments and the export of European renewable energy equipments to continents like Africa and etc.
Thank you, Simone. My first reaction to your comprehensive explanation of what green industrial policy should be and should be used for is basically getting back to Piotr, because what he was telling me before about what is going on in Poland, and we speak about Poland because we have Piotr, but this is an example of what is going on in many other places, as was mentioned before. So that's why I'm interested to get that point of view. It's like, how are you getting equipped for this industrial revolution? And how are you seeing these two sides of the things, you know, like the challenge, but also the opportunity that this might constitute?
It's mainly a challenge. I would say many see that in our countries, that this is mainly a challenge because businesses tend to be conservative in terms of what they see and what they do. This is Western companies and corporations adapted for this process before. They have, you know, developed technology, process of going climate neutral or not even climate neutral, but adapting to the climate change process, and the debate started before. And this is why many of the pledges of international corporations and shifts in strategies we're seeing in Western Europe. So that's why many of the businesses, which are more from a different era, I would say, don't see that much as a potential. But there, of course, is a potential. First off, because of the financing and the process of additional revenues and projects that could be financed by the EU Recovery Fund in the next years, also by the European Investment Bank and the projects that it's going to finance. And many businesses probably are going to, as they did before, adapt to this and change their business orientations. I think one of the biggest and most interesting processes in Poland is connected not only with the decreasing the emissions of industrial production, which happened, but also with going through the process of recycling all of the produce that is being produced by industries. And this is something that we see in many businesses and many industrial corporations also Polish ones, when they probably see a decrease in spending and then a possible decrease in risks connected also with climate change, because the process that we all talk about is also influencing currently the businesses that are running in Europe. So the floods that sometimes happen and the processes of climate neutrality basically also has an impact on agriculture production. And we see a lot of increases in the costs of producing agricultural products. And I would say that most of the businesses that 2 or 3 years ago were saying that we're not interested in going climate neutral, we're not interested in decreasing the emissions, they see that the thing that they sometimes neglected is actually happening currently. And it affects how they do their business. And probably what they look for is a framework for them to change what they were doing through the last 20 or 15 years to a new model, I would say. And I hope that the schemes and the projects and also the increased funding that we see in the next multi-annual financial framework, but also with the Just Transition Fund and other of those funds that we see, are going to be enough for them to adapt to this change and to see less of the challenge and more of the opportunity to shift their business.
Thank you, Piotr. I'm looking at Heather because on one hand, there is this whole economic policy tool and industrial policy tool that we have and this promise of disruption and the challenges, but also the opportunity. So I would like to, first of all, have a comment on this part, but also if you help me to bridge towards understanding the wider societal challenges behind the economic consequences of all these that we need to take into consideration in order to get a transition that works for all.
What's fundamental to the success of any economic transition is a perspective that businesses and also everybody in society has a sense of where we are moving to. That was vital for the success of Poland's economic transition, that EU membership gave the promise both of liberties and also economic prosperity. And that kept the transition going, even when there were big changes of government and there was opposition. It will be like that also on the climate transition, because people need to have a sense of what will be valued in the future. And that's why I think more important than an industrial policy per se is fundamental changes to the incentive structures and the signals that people have about what will be assets and what will be liabilities in the future. If people hold on to their petrol-fueled cars and their gas-heated homes because they don't believe that they will get something better in the future, it will be extremely difficult to get the European Green Deal to work. But if there's a change to the fundamental incentive structures by pricing in the actual environmental and climate costs of fossil fuels, for example, and a change in incentives in terms of pricing the new technologies and also the economic opportunities accurately, that will make the transition happen much, much faster. That's why the measures that the EU is taking, like the taxonomy, also using that, for example, by central banks and also for risk assessment, for example, by the insurance industry, that will move things much faster. That's where market forces could push things in the right direction if government, and particularly the EU, sets the incentives right. So people need to see that their diesel vehicle is soon going to become a stranded asset, because then they're going to move to electric much faster. The businesses need to have a sense that the infrastructure that's very carbon intensive at the moment will soon become a liability on their balance sheet and their shareholders won't want to see it there anymore. That's what moves the private sector investment and consolidates the transition, makes it irreversible. So I would argue that the green industrial policy shouldn't certainly be about picking winners or national champions. It's certainly true there needs to be a lot more investment in research and innovation, setting up the manufacturing capacity. But fundamentally, if you change the price incentives, that will all happen a lot faster than writing it out as national plans or even at the EU level.
I understand. But how you manage to make these incentives acceptable? Like, how do you manage to make the educational effort, which is not only an educational effort, in order to make all this something that actually people would like to go for it?
Well, here I think Piotr's fundamental point about opportunities is vital, that business needs to change its orientations. They need a framework, he said, to change to the new model. That's the role of the state. That's the role of the EU and national governments to show this is what the zero carbon economy is going to look like. And here are the massive opportunities that you're going to have, both for selling within the single market, but also selling internationally, as Simona was saying. Pushing the European Green Deal beyond borders is very important in terms of making technology available, but also showing the economic opportunities for all of the market actors. What's key is that it is not seen as a zero-sum game. The really dangerous thing for the political economy of the climate transition is if people feel that their interests are pitted against the interests of others and that they need to grab as much a compensation as they can in the short term and depict themselves as losers by clinging on to the old infrastructure and the old business models. That would be a disaster. And that's why I think the idea of the European Recovery Fund being used to bail out industries which should have disinvested from areas they can see are unsustainable a long time ago is really quite dangerous. It's also vital it's not seen as a protectionist agenda globally, because there needs to be some climate justice in terms of the global transition. If there's a sense in the global south that, for example, the carbon border adjustment mechanism is simply a new form of tariff, a new form of protectionism, then they're not going to get on board for that either. So moving out of the zero-sum mindset of if you win in this transition, I will lose, into here is how we can all win because we are all moving towards this zero carbon economy. That is fundamental, and that's the job of the politicians, particularly at EU level.
Simone, I was seeing that you wanted to have a quick reaction to what Heather just said.
Yeah, well, yes, I think that I totally subscribe to what was just said. I think it will be, in any case, very important to always bear in mind that we need to do two things to people to really unleash this transformation. First, we need to ensure alternatives are available. So we cannot simply say to people, you need to get out of your diesel car. We also need to, in cities, come up with the public transport that really makes it possible to use a different mode of moving around. We need to invest in trains, railways for the medium, long journeys, etc. So alternatives is important. This is something that the state needs to provide. And second, I think we should always bear in mind that compensations will be needed for the most vulnerable segment of the society. So if we introduce, and I totally agree, a sensible carbon price in transport, the effect will be higher cost of gasoline at the pump tomorrow. We need to take care of those that, one, do not have any other alternative than using their gasoline or diesel car because they maybe live in rural areas where public transport is not developed. And second, do not have the resources to buy an electric car, which is still for the rich today. Therefore, we need to compensate. And that can be done. Switzerland, also in Canada, we have examples of the state providing lump sums according to the income level to compensate for the higher price of the gasoline due to the carbon price. So this is possible. We haven't done so far sufficiently in Europe. We need to do that.
So basically, on one hand, affordability of clean technology, and secondly, compensation. That's what I get out of both the conversations that are being held over there. And I would like to hear from Piotr if those two are also the kind of strategic approaches that you would see working over there in Poland.
So if I may add, then I see another issue that is connected with those two. It's energy poverty. So you have a great number of households across Central and Eastern Europe, but also in the South of Europe, that use those unsustainable sources of energy because they are the cheapest. What the states are doing around Europe, in Poland and Central and Eastern Europe, is that they subsidize the shift of the sources of energy that people use. You know, people in Poland, they tend to use coal in order to heat their housing. And this is a process that has to take some time. But you need to have some initiatives for those households in order for them to not use the cheapest their source of energy that they find the easiest, and because they were using it for 50 or 100 years of time. But you need to find a redistributive mechanism for those households, which is ensuring that they're not left behind. Because you won't get those people on board with the policies that you're pursuing. And for sure, you're going to get them to be climate deniers if you're not going to have a possible solution for the problem that they face. And as we saw in France with the protests throughout time, in each European country, we can see a group of people also being dissatisfied with the energy transition policies if their cost is going to be unbearable for the lower deciles. And this is also what we have to take into account, each European country, and have a framework, basically. Tell the people what they have to do. Help them change their ways of doing stuff if it's not the way that we want them to behave. You know, we see the same things happening with the vaccines. We have anti-vaccine movements as a backlash to overall and sensible policies and science. And if you don't want to see that, then you need to have a good discussion with this group of people in order to not let them think and be a threat to the whole process itself. If you don't have some specific redistributive mechanisms and some kind of message to them.
Piotr, I'm almost running out of time soon, but I would like to pick up your last point, because basically we've been speaking about the economic tools, we've been speaking about what kind of redistribution policies we can have, but you are introducing a very important element of this, which is not only the financial part of the compensations or the redistribution and so on, but also I would almost call it the democratic challenge of involving and building a certain ownership in all segments of society for this kind of transition. And I'm looking at Heather, if you would like to comment on that last part, because I feel that this is one of the biggest challenges that we have in actually setting up these kind of policies. It's not just about getting the right financing, getting the right mix. It's also about how do we get it working for our democracies.
Maintaining democratic consent through this long climate transition is the biggest challenge, because it's not just about winning one election with a green wave, it's winning a whole series of elections and making sure the climate measures can survive many changes of government in many countries. And I think the vital thing to do is to show that the transition will be fair, that there will be compensatory measures by governments and by the EU, but they'll be on the basis of economic need rather than on the basis of lobbying power. That's the dangerous thing, I think, at the moment about the recovery funds and Next Generation EU, that governments have a lot of money in their hands nationally rather than through EU-level programs, and they will be extremely tempted to use that money to bail out the companies which have a loud voice and large lobbying power rather than the vulnerable in their societies who are suffering but don't have that kind of political clout. And the lesson of the Gilets Jaunes is that when people have been left behind for a very long time and they finally come together around an issue, they can be incredibly disruptive. So governments need to show that the costs of adjustment will be fairly distributed, and that fundamental principles of climate policy, like the polluter pays, will actually be used when it comes to compensation. So we see the way that the state aid taps were turned on during the COVID pandemic for airlines, for example. Is that really the best use of the money? Shouldn't it have been targeted directly at the vulnerable in society rather than on the basis of if you bail out the companies and they'll continue providing jobs? Because that bakes into the transition existing injustices, and it makes the private sector responsible for the social effects, which usually doesn't work very well in terms of political economy. The state needs to do that. So I think there are fundamental issues about justice, which are important, not just philosophically, because justice matters, but also to make it politically sustainable. And I would argue that there are several aspects of justice. So there's the one about the poor in society now, vulnerable groups, for example, the Roma, who clearly need help to make this transition. But there's also the justice between regions, between especially global north, global south, because the people who've contributed the least to the greenhouse gas emissions are likely to face the highest costs of adaptation, for example, in Africa. And there's a further dimension of justice, which is the intergenerational justice, that the investments we're making now will determine how our grandchildren and great-grandchildren live in the future. So we need to keep that much broader perspective on all of this. It's not just about compensation now. It's about what happens. happened to the overall justice over the next decades.
Thank you. And I would like to have also a last reflection before we close this episode about exactly this topic, but also any other things that we might have left behind, but really in a nutshell. So I ask first Simone to have his last words.
Yeah, I think we need to be honest. So politicians have to build an honest narrative around this issue. We should not promote Green New Deals as economic silver bullet. We need to say, look, this is a transition that is necessary because otherwise the cost will simply be much higher. This will make your life better because it's not just about climate change, but it's also about reducing air pollution and making your environment better locally. And this is something that will be a bumpy road ahead, but is necessary. And we need to do everything is possible to make it as smooth as possible. This is going to be a reallocation mechanism. That's how I interpret Green New Deals, not economic silver bullet, but a reallocation mechanism that are there to manage a transformation like others we have seen in history, because this is not the first industrial revolution we are facing.
Thank you, Simone. Piotr?
Probably in the next 10 or maybe 20 years, we're going to see another crisis in Europe, and probably is going to be induced by climate change. And this is going to shift the attention of many politicians across Europe towards climate neutrality. Up to 2013, 2014, we didn't see the lot of commitment that we saw. The increasing in temperatures, which affected the everyday life of each citizen in Europe, it broadened the awareness of the issue. And I would say that this is probably what is going to hit us next in the upcoming years. And it's probably going to be this another different, I don't know, gray rhinoceros or black swan issue that somehow is going to shift our attention and probably make the process even faster and the adaptation of European businesses even faster. But up to that point, I'm quite certain that some of the EU recovery money is going to be used to bail out the businesses which are fossil-oriented because of the social concern and the more economic concern of many countries and also from the European Commission. So the COVID-19 pandemic, we emitted less CO2 through 2020 and probably are going to in 2021. But then on the process of recovery, we're going to emit the same number as we would through the last 2 years.
And we could stay here for much longer debating and discussing all these analysis and reflections, because obviously this is quite a wide topic as we've been seeing in this episode. But unfortunately, that's all we have for now. And we should close this conversation. I would like to thank all of you for joining The Sound of Economics. And I would like to remind you that you can access all our analysis on the topic of climate transition, the distributional challenges, and the European Green Deal, written by Simone, but also by our other experts on the Bruegel website on www.bruegel.org. So until next time, bye-bye.